Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Today on Midnight in Karachi, I'm joined by Nedi Okorafor, who is the writer of multiple novels, both for young adults and adults. Some of her much-loved children's books are Zara the Windseeker, Akata Witch, The Shadow Speaker. Her novels for adults are Who Fears Death and last year's Lagoon, a great romp of an alien invasion story set in Lagos, Nigeria, which I loved. Nedi has won multiple awards. Her short stories have been published in many, many places. And she's also a university professor. Her most recent novel is The Fierce, the Book of Phoenix, which is a sort of loose prequel to the world of Who Fears Death. Nedi, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, I think you know how excited I've been about the Book of Phoenix, because I've been quite vocal about it well before it came out. And it started life as a short story that I really, really enjoyed. It may have been my favorite short story by you, other than perhaps this little Beyoncé-inspired secret story that we won't talk about. But tell us about how the Book of Phoenix came to be, and tell us a little bit about it. I know this was a story that kept growing, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was a story that I didn't want to write, first of all, because I was tired and I wanted to take a break, and it just kept coming. There are several places where it started, but one of the places where it started was when I visited the day that I won the World Fantasy Award, and I happened to be visiting one of my students in jail at that time. And it was a very strange situation, because it was a Cook County prison in Chicago, and when you go in there, they take your cell phone and everything, and so you're kind of disconnected from the world. I knew that the World Fantasy Award was the award ceremony was happening that evening, but I was really more concerned with my student. And so I went in, and when I came out, that was when I found out that, and I came out angry because I got to see all of these young black men in prison just languishing. And it was really a disturbing, eye-opening experience for me, that really brought home things that I already knew about the United States prison system, but it really brought it home to see it with my own eyes. And so when I came out, I was angry and upset. And I remember sitting in the car, and I turned my cell phone on, and that was when my phone started buzzing like crazy with text messages. And that was how I learned that I had won the World Fantasy Award for Who Fears Death. So it was like this weird kind of happy, angry mix that just kind of, that was where the spark started. And then at some point, there was a line in Who Fears Death that just stuck out and that I always remembered. And it was a line where the young Onyesonwu was talking about reading the great book. And she talks about a man who could walk through walls and a man who could eat glass, you know, and that line always stuck out to me. So like all of these things kind of swirled in my head. And at some point I sat down and just wrote the short story that was the Book of Phoenix. And this character came to me, this character who was in Tower 7, and she was imprisoned, and something happens where she has to get out and she seeks her freedom. So kind of the idea of jail, of prisons in the United States, combined with my own rage about the system, about the machine, and you know, just that those lines from Who Fears Death were the cataclysm that became this story. So I wrote the story and I created this character, Phoenix. And the short story was about her escape from, or her attempted escape from Tower 7 and what happens when she seeks her freedom, the disaster that occurs and the destruction that occurs when she wakes up and seeks her freedom. And so I finished that story and it was published in Clark's World, and I kind of set it down and I'm like, okay, got that out of my system. And then I just kept thinking about her and thinking about her and thinking about her. And so the next thing you know, I'm sitting down and when I was thinking about her, I'm hearing her voice again in my head. And she was very pushy, you know, write this, continue my story, see what happens next. And so then I ended up writing what was my second novella. Novelette. Novelette. I get those things mixed up. Whatever.
Me too.
Longer story.
Longer story, yes.
It was a longer story, and that was published as African Sunrise. So it was just like, it just continued right where the Book of Phoenix short story left off. It just kept going. And so I finished that. I'm like, okay, now that's out of my system. I can just rest now. And no, I couldn't rest. As a matter of fact, even when I remember I was thinking about the story, and then I'm like, I'm not writing that anymore. I'm done. And I tried to take a nap. And when I took the nap, she was talking to me in my sleep, saying, get up, write this, write it, finish it. And so then next thing you know, I'm writing a novel, and and I had, you know, and the rest is basically history. So it's like, I didn't want to write it, but it just had to happen.
That's really interesting. So my next question anyway was about this woman, this character, Phoenix, who's fascinating, this accelerated human woman grown to age 40 in a few years' time in an experiment facility, in our future, strange powers she's only just learning to control and use and understand when we first meet her, and then an even stranger, more interesting journey ahead of her. Has she been in your head in some shape or form since you wrote Who Fears Death?
Yes. Definitely. She's been there. She's been there, like, and I can say this now after I've written it, and I can in hindsight, because a lot of things happen where I'm not fully aware of why or how, when it was happening. But when I look back, she was definitely there. Probably just after I finished Who Fears Death. The connection between Onyesonwu and Phoenix is very, very strong. I like to say that Phoenix is Onyesonwu's older, angrier sister.
Right.
You know, she was definitely there and kind of just waiting for her time. So it's when I wrote her, when I look back, I'm not very surprised. And the rage and the anger and the destruction that she brings doesn't surprise me either.
Well, I liked her. For all of those terrible things, I quite enjoyed her. Now, most of the specimen, as you call them, the people who have been experimented on, altered, changed, and even weaponized in the Book of Phoenix are African, aren't they? Or of African origin, if we can say that. It isn't very difficult to draw parallels between that, how they've been treated in the book, and slavery and the history of slavery. It's a very political choice, really, to do this. Can one, a writer like you, for example, even avoid the politics of race and of gender?
No. It's not, because I don't live in a vacuum, and these things are there. And whether I want them to be whether I want people to read through that lens or not, they will be. My work will be read through that lens. And also, like I said, I don't live in a vacuum, so I know I'm drawing off of a lot of that. I live it. You know, I'm Nigerian American, black, and female.
Right.
And that's been my experience. And I've gone through that experience with very open eyes. I've always been honest in what I see and very observant, too. That's part of what makes me a writer, that I observe. But I also participate. It doesn't bother me that my work is read in that way. In terms of issues of slavery, those weren't things that I was conscious of when I wrote it. I wasn't consciously thinking about those things, but I know they were in my subconscious.
Right.
You know, I think about the transatlantic slave trade all the time. I think about, and its subsequent effects over time. I think about the Arab slave trade and its subsequent effects over time. I think about more recent reverberations of those things and those issues. Those are more in my conscious mind than the distant past. So those things definitely were whipped into the story, certainly.
Now, we haven't spoken, I think, since before Lagoon came out. We haven't had a lengthy conversation. That, I think, Lagoon was a bit of a departure, I personally think, from your previous novel for adults, Who Fears Death. I loved Lagoon, and I enjoyed greatly this feeling that you seem to sort of let go into this big, as I said, great romp of a novel. I enjoyed it so, so much. It just let go and spread its little tentacles, its wild tentacles, into so many different directions. But it, of course, was still one whole creature. It seemed such a great time with it, so much fun with it. Was it a very different writing experience for you? And for that matter, was The Book of Phoenix also?
Yes. Lagoon is very different from the type of story that I am typically, that I don't want to say that there's a type of story that I typically write, even though I guess there kind of is, but like it was very different because, for one, like point of view, that's a big one. I like to write from one character's point of view, very close, and get deep into that character's head. I love doing that.
Right.
I love doing that, and get it just as close as possible, and see, so that you can see the complexities of that one character. Lagoon was different. I had read Stephen King's Under the Dome, and I loved that book. I loved it. I loved the length of it. I loved the expansiveness of it. I loved the fact that it was so expansive, but it all took place under a dome. I loved the fact that it was he wrote so many different points of view, and he juggled them all. You know, he made it so that, you know, a lot of times when I would read I would kind of dislike stories where there were lots of different points of views, where you just kept jumping from one to another, because a lot of times there'd be one character that you really love and you want to stay with that character, and then there'd be another character that you really don't like that much,
right,
and the story would jump to that character and you'd be like, oh, and you got to slog through that. But Under the Dome was different in that he made it all work. Every character was interesting. It was all interconnected. And I loved that. And I wanted to try that. You know, I know what I'm used to doing and I know what I'm good at, but I also know that in order to grow as a writer, you have to try different things and explore different things. And so when I wrote Lagoon, I was trying something else. You know, I was trying something else that was very much out of my comfort zone, very much. And so, you know, when I wrote that, I was writing all of these different points of view, from animal to different types of people. And I knew that I wanted to write about Lagos. I wanted to write about that city, because that city has scared me for many years.
Right.
I love that city, but it's crazy. And you can't write about Lagos. You can't write from one point of view about that city. There is no way. So in that way, I also knew I had to try this thing that I saw Stephen King do so successfully. So there was that. And also with Lagoon, I had lots of fun. That was, I'd finished writing Who Fears Death, and I'd done Akata Witch, and both of those have like serious dark elements, but I wanted to have fun. Like, Who Fears Death drained me. Who Fears Death was just an extremely difficult book to write. It took from me, I really think that it probably took some time off of my life. It's worth it, but it probably did. And so I wanted to do something fun. And when I do fun, it's not just, you know, it's not light. It's satire-y kind of fun, where I'm kind of looking at different issues and poking at different issues in a fun way, but serious as well. So Lagoon, I like to describe Lagoon as possibly my most obnoxious novel, you know, the most obnoxious novel that I've ever written. And it was fun doing that. It was fun. There were things that I was doing in there that, you know, some readers who aren't that familiar with Nigerian history, politics, and culture might not catch, but there were some really crazy things that I did in that book, and I love the fact that it was published. Now, The Book of Phoenix was like, in a lot of ways, it was like Who Fears Death. It was returning to a sort of dark, kind of a dark but adventure-filled type of story. You know, where you've got a character that is going through certain things and dealing with certain issues, but she's on the move. She's on the move. And so the types of story that Who Fears Death and The Book of Phoenix are, they're both very difficult. There were aspects of The Book of Phoenix that were really difficult for me to write as well. But I enjoyed the adventure of it. That's where kind of I took joy from her, the adventure of her travel and her moving and all of that. I really enjoyed that. But yeah, writing The Book of Phoenix is very similar to the writing of Who Fears Death.
Now, that's interesting. What you were just talking about is using different points of view to tell a story, especially when it comes to a story like Lagos, which, you know, I understand. I mean, I've never been to Nigeria, but I still relate, because Karachi is, as I keep telling you, so, so similar. It's a schizophrenic city. One voice is never enough in so many ways. Right. And yet at the same time, there is a parallel in that kind of storytelling with an ancient oral art of storytelling, because you have an omniscient narrative. And that all these sort of different actions and different storylines come together, but we're told about many different characters doing many different things. So to me, that sort of played in as well. It was almost an ancient art brought back to life to tell mm-hmm. the story of this ancient city.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, oh, and I completely agree with that. I'm observant and I listen. And I think that in listening, I've incorporated a lot of forms of storytelling that I'm not completely conscious of. Like, I listen to Igbo relatives or Nigerian relatives just talking and telling stories and listening to the way they tell the stories and the standpoint. And I'm like, and I'll incorporate that in a subconscious way, though. And so when I sit down to write, it comes out. It just comes out naturally. There were things in Lagoon that just came out naturally, and they were all from my own observations and experiences within my own Nigerian culture. So yeah, that's definitely something I think was happening with Lagoon.
Now, I know you don't start off with a decision about whether you're writing young adult, whether you're writing adult mm-hmm. stories. I know some writers may, but I know you've previously told me that you don't do that. When mm-hmm. do you know where you're headed, though?
I don't.
Do you just wait for your agent to tell you?
Yes. I just wait. I write the thing, and then I let other people read it and let them figure out what it is, because I don't know what it is. And I know when I'm writing something, I don't think about that at all. And until the thing is done, until it's whole, until it's living. And so until it's at the point of no return where I can't let it be affected by categories. And that's how I've always written. And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that. Like, I can't. When I could sit down writing something about a child, and it turned out to be an adult story. There was one short story in Kabu Kabu, the Black Stain. That was it, the Black Stain. And I thought, you know, I initially thought that this was going to be kind of a young adult story. It was a story that's linked to Who Fears Death. And once I started writing it, that story was extremely adult and extremely disturbing and really, really, in a lot of ways, problematic. But I, you know, at one point when I first started writing it, I was like, oh, this is going to be nice and light and fun. And no, it wasn't. So
no matter how many chickens you threw into that one, it wasn't going to be nice and light and fun. I know that story. Now, I know you've been incredibly busy, novels after novels after novels, up from 2010 up until now. I think you've published Who Fears Death, Akata Witch, Kabu Kabu, Lagoon, and now The Book of Phoenix. I mean, obviously these books weren't all written in the last 5 years, or were they? Because that is just madness.
Nope, those are all books. I've been writing, like, it's funny, because people think that I'm just a machine and I'm just churning these things
out. You are.
But I'm not.
You're so disciplined. It's amazing, though.
But I've been writing these things, like, before I was, like, before, since...
Forever.
Zara the World Seeker, I've been writing these things. And over long periods of time, like, The Book of Phoenix, I think, took me 4 years to write that. You know? Lagoon took me about 4 years. It's like, I can't write a book a year. I don't write quickly. Like, I can throw out a first draft fairly quickly. Once I get in the zone, once I'm in, I can't stop until the thing is done. But that first draft is a mess. It's got typos, inconsistencies. It's a mess. And it will take me a long time to keep editing and editing and editing and editing until the thing is even something that I would show to other people. So, like, all the books that are coming out are things that I've been writing over a long period of time in quietness. Even now, like, I'm working on something new. And then, you know, a few years from now, as these books are coming out, then when those after that, then the next books will come out and so on. So it's like I'm just always working on something. And I've been always working on something for many years. It's just that they weren't published back then. So I had basically a good head start. And so when I had that head start, I've written so many novels now that the process gets easier and easier. I get faster and faster. So everything is kind of working together. So I'm definitely not a machine. I'm very, very busy and I have a lot of things going on, but I have a strict writing routine. It's not like I write at the exact same time every day for this amount of notes, but I make sure that I have a writing routine that I can't define, but it's very solid, if that makes sense.
It doesn't, but I'll believe you. But here's the thing. This is what's interesting in a way. I mean, of course, no one expects that you've written this novel. I mean, like you've said, you've been working on this stuff for a long time. But here's the thing. It means that you are switching between voices for novels simultaneously. I mean, you're working on more than one thing at the same time. That in itself cannot be an easy process. You get edits on one thing, but you're writing another, you're drafting a third. How does that even work?
It's become more and more, because before I would only work on one thing at a time. And now I still do only work on one thing at a time, but it's like when I finish that, then I move on to the next thing, then I move on to the next thing. So because I very much about voice and very much about character. And so when I'm working on something, I am in that. Like I can't work on this book and then tomorrow work on another thing. That would cause like this kind of problem with my brain that would hurt. It would probably physically hurt if I tried to do that. So typically if I am editing, if I'm working on something, I will wait I will take the time to work that whole thing out. And then if I get edits for a novel, then when I get that new thing to a point where it needs to be, where I feel like I can step away from it, that's when I step away from it. And then I turn to the edits for the novel. So I find ways to keep them separate. I have to keep them separate because otherwise it's not fun anymore. And also it wouldn't work. But yeah, I keep all the voices very, very separate. All the voices and the world as well, very separate.
And you're still teaching university, aren't you?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
How is that working out? I know the last time we spoke a couple of years ago, you weren't very, very happy with where you were, but you've moved now and you seem much happier.
Yes. I was teaching at Chicago State University and it just was not the right place for me at all. It's not really a great place for a writer who is writing. I was teaching four classes and they were all unique. Four unique classes per semester. And two of them were composition, one and two. So I was just very unhappy there. And that wasn't even what I had signed up for when I got there. They just slowly crept that schedule up on me as the years passed. And so I knew I needed to get out of there. And then somewhere along the lines, the University at Buffalo came along and basically stole me from that university. And so now that's where I am. And I'm very happy here because I'm teaching two classes a semester, which is great. Going from four to two is like, it's just magic. And so I also get to teach a science fiction class and a creative writing class, sometimes advanced, sometimes introductory. So I'm teaching my area. I'm teaching what I love. And I get to teach African literature. I think it's two semesters from now. So I'm in a really, really good place. They like what I'm doing. They like that I'm publishing. They're interested. It's wonderful. And so, one of the good things about teaching as a writer is, at least for me, it's something that I feel like I'll always have to do no matter what, because one, teaching gets me out of my head, you know, that the idea of helping other up and coming students and giving them the knowledge that I've kind of accumulated, it's a wonderful thing for both my students and for myself. If I didn't teach, I would always write. And then you'd start seeing crazy, crazy Nettie. No one wants to see that. No one wants to see that.
Come on, just a little peek. Just a little
No.
bit. I want to see the stories that Crazy Nettie comes up with.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. I think teaching keeps me very balanced. It's very necessary, you know. So yeah, I think I found a very good place. I'm in a very good place when it comes to the teaching and the writing.
Some questions via Twitter. Jonah asks, was there an episode, an animal or spirit that you wanted to include in Lagoon, but you didn't?
Let's see. One thing about Lagoon is, yes, those animal those animal parts, the sections where I got to be in the animal's point of view, those were some of the most enjoyable parts of the book for me as a writer. I loved writing those. I loved writing from the perspective of a tarantula. I loved writing from the perspective of a bat and a swordfish. It was so fun. I would have liked to have more animal perspective parts, but I don't think they would have fit with the three-act structure. Like, I would have liked to have a leopard, and because the leopard is very, there's a deep mythology with the leopard, especially amongst the Igbo and the people of southeastern Nigeria. So there's a leopard, and especially being such a mysterious creature. But I think I'll save the leopard for Akatawich too. But also, another animal I would have liked to write the perspective of is a python, which also has like a deep mythical background in Nigerian culture. And I would have also liked to have one deity that was from the Hausa ethnic group, because I wanted to hit the three major ethnicities in Nigeria. You've got, but in Lagoon, you've got Yoruba and Igbo, but I would have liked to have one Hausa. You can't have all of the ethnicities in there represented, because there are tons of them in Nigerian culture, but I would have liked to have the three, just to kind of even it out.
And a second question from Maineke, whose name I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, asks about your use of language in Lagoon and the easy use of local dialect especially. Did you trust to your readers to follow along, or did you debate taking it out?
Oh yes, the pidgin English. Yes, Lagoon is full of pidgin English. There are characters who speak like flat out, you know, deep, deep Nigerian pidgin English. And I had a lot of help with that, because I don't speak it very well. I understand most of it, but I definitely am no expert in pidgin English. So I had a lot of help with those sections. When I first wrote Lagoon and showed it to my editor, I knew those pidgin English sections were difficult. And I was like, oh boy, I have no idea what she's going to think. But I wanted to write it the way that I envisioned it. So I kind of just threw it down on there the way I wanted it to be, without making it less and making it without toning any of it down. And I just showed it to my editor. And so then I was like, okay, let's see what she says. Let's see what she says. And I was going to go by, I was going to make whatever decisions I made about the pidgin English, I was going to make them according with the input of my editor. You know, because I don't believe that I know everything, and I'm okay with listening to advice. So I waited, and then my editor, Ann Perry, my editor at Hodder and Stoughton, came back to me and was like, I love the pidgin English. Just keep it in there. And I was like, yes, 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 yes. Okay, so that's another vote for what I wanted to keep in there. So I knew it would be difficult. And I know for people who have never even heard Nigerian pidgin English and are not familiar with any of it, it must almost read like a completely different language. But it is pidgin English. So
right.
It is, if you kind of relax your ear and just relax, you can get it. You can get it. And then I also put a glossary at the end. You know, that was, I think it was my editor's idea to put that glossary at the end. I was like, fine, you know, at the end, when readers didn't even know it was there. So that worked for me. But yeah, it was definitely something that I thought about. But I also figure that science fiction readers and those who are reading science fiction, because science fiction readers and those who read science fiction can sometimes be two different things, should come to this with an open mind, ready to learn something new, ready to experience the unfamiliar. It's okay to experience something that you are not well versed in. It's good. It's good. So those were the things that made me keep it in there.
That's what makes science fiction interesting, is mm-hmm. that element of the unfamiliar. Because if we knew everything, we'd just stick to the usual realist novels about people being depressed.
Exactly. Which are boring.
Which are boring, true. All right, now, you said in an interview a while ago, you said all stories are powerful juju. What sorts of particular juju are your stories?
Tricky juju. Yeah, I'd say tricky, trickster. Because there are things that my stories are doing, like on the surface, that I expect the reader to be like, oh, yeah, I find that so familiar. I've seen this before. Oh, yeah, I enjoyed this type of story. But then there are things, there are undercurrents working beneath that surface of familiar that I hope are working on the reader and that are new to the reader. So it's like that. That's how I would describe my stories. Trickster.
So what's next for you? More trickster Jutu?
Yes. Easy that one. Yes.
Another novel next year, another two novels in the next 2 years. What's going on?
Well, I know that, so I have a novella that Tor.com has just bought called Binti. Well, not just bought, it's been a little while now, but it's called Binti. And that story, I guess it would be described as a space opera. You know, I'm not quite sure. It's in space and stuff. And stuff happens in space. So.
That's a space opera. That's enough space and stuff. Stuff happening in space. That's space opera. If it's not science, it's space opera.
Right. So I think that's how it would, like, that's how people would describe it. But, like Star Wars type of stuff.
That's interesting. I would never have pegged you for space opera.
Yeah, me neither.
Your work is so earthy. You know what I mean? Like, it almost sounds ridiculous to say, but it's so tactile. It's so earthy. Yeah. And here you've gone all the way out there. Are there arachnids in space? Just tell me now.
Well.
Really?
Eventually there will be. No.
There will be arachnids everywhere.
But it's funny that you're describing it as describing my work as earthy, because the main character, Binti, she's like the Himba people. That's Himba, for those who want to look that up. She's based on the Himba. The Himba people are known for covering their skin with clay, red clay. You know, that's part of their way of keeping clean and also beauty. You know, so she comes from that group of people, and she comes from a group of people who never leave Earth.
Right.
They never leave Earth except her. She's the first. And so there's a lot behind her. I don't want to like summarize her story, but yeah, she's got the earth on her, you know, and that's a big part of the story as well. So even though you could describe the story as, I guess, a space opera, there are other things that are, there are other undercurrents beneath it, and they're very much there, and they're very, in Binti, they're very African and Arab as well. This story was inspired when I was in the United Arab Emirates, and I was in Sharjah, and there's a lagoon there, and I looked down into the lagoon, and for the first time in my entire life, I saw a jellyfish, and it was alive, and it was kind of swimming. And I was like, whoo! And it was blue, and that just sparked something about aliens in my head. And so that was the beginning of this story. And so you've got the ancient modern culture of the United Arab Emirates, kind of, which is the what this story is deeply based in as well. So it takes place in space, but you still have the cultural stuff that the story is deeply based on, and not just science fiction-y cultural stuff. I'm talking just, you know, your typical earthly cultural stuff going on. So that's supposed to come out in September. And then I've got, I have my children's book, The Chicken in the Kitchen.
That's adorable. And I'm going to get it wrong every time I say it, I'm sure.
Yes, it is a bit of a tongue twister. So that's a flat out children's picture book. And in that way, it's my first, because Long Juju Man had more prose in it. This was where I actually wrote a children's picture book. So very few words in it. And the illustrator is from Iran. And so we've kind of teamed up and worked really closely together on this. And the story is set in Nigeria. It's set in present day Nigeria. And it is about a giant chicken in this little girl's kitchen.
It's like the world version of The Tiger Who Came to Tea. We finally got a story for us.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. It's just, there's a side of me. See, I'll write things like Who Fears Death and The Book of Phoenix, but there's also this whimsical side of me where I just love, you know, that writing for kids and they're just those things that are ridiculous that they just love, you know, just ridiculous, nonsensical fun thing. So yeah, that's what The Chicken in the Kitchen is. And so that's due out in September. And then next year, Akata Witch 2 will be released. And so I'm currently in the editing process with that. And even with this initial draft of the book, I love what I ended up writing. I love it. I love it. I love it. It's like Akata Witch, the first one, but just amped up, and it's taken farther, and the writing is better, and the storytelling is even, it's just more. So I'm already really pleased. We're tentatively calling it Breaking Cola, which is, it's an Igbo, Google it, you know, there's a whole Breaking Cola. And I'm really excited about that. And then after that, there are some things. I always have things in the mix. There are things that I'm working on. There are other novels that I'm currently working on. There are two in particular. So yeah, got some stuff that I'm doing.
So you've got the novels we won't speak of. You've got Breaking Cola. You've got and that's Akata Witch 2. And then you've got novella about earthy people in space.
Yes.
Yes. I'm so onto your tricksteriness. I've figured out this earthy stuff. I'm on to Unity. There is no getting away now. That's a lot going on, though. That's really impressive.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy it. It's fun. I mean, the stories, I love the stories, and I just love the creation of it, and I love when it's all finished, and you can just sit back and read it, and you'd be like, wow, this is really cool. So it's not work to me. It's enjoyable. Wholly enjoyable. Even the hardest aspects of the editing process are enjoyable. There's another book I have, that one's, I don't know if I can announce that yet, but yeah, there's another book. It's young adult, and it is, let me see, is it due out next year? It's either next year or, yeah, next year. Yeah, we'll just keep it at that.
But I'm just going to wait if you want to add another book to that list. I'm not going to say anything else. Just go ahead. I'm going to give you some breathing space and go ahead.
There's so many things that I forget. It's crazy.
I don't even know how many lists you must keep. I mean, and then you've got your classes and you've got a kid. I mean, amazing. I don't know how you do it. You know what's really, truly the most impressive out of everything? And I'm going to be really superficial. It's that you still go to the gym every single day. I am so impressed. Never will I fail to be impressed by that, because every time, and I've emailed you when I've been at the gym and you've been like, yeah, go do this. And I've said, my God, how does this woman do it? If she can do it, I have no excuse. And I, you know, pick up some weights and stuff.
Yeah, that's part of me. That's like breathing. Even when I was, there were 2 weeks this year where, like, between February and March, where I was traveling like crazy. I mean, like, I went to Oman, Canada, then Chicago, then Los Angeles, and then Canada again. It was crazy. And all that time, everywhere I went, I found the gym. Everywhere. Always. And when you can't find a gym, you go to YouTube, and there are these exercise videos, and I use those. You can always get Wi-Fi.
Hey, if nothing else, you can just do some jumping jacks and a whole lot of push-ups, and even that will work.
Yes, exactly.
There's no excuse. Exactly. Yes, yes. I understand. I get it. Okay, I'm going to go back tomorrow morning. I will be there.
Yep. Good.
Yeah, I will be there. All right, so hopefully we will speak to you again when all these other novels come out.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk.
Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for interviewing me.